The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
RealArea.com.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Over a couple of months, the first part of this year, 2011,
And it's on the political theory, the political ideas of Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Mm.
And it's never been done before. There's been a lot of stuff out there on his particular policies, foreign, domestic policies, economic institutions that he's created, stuff like that. But no one has ever tried to put together what this guy is all about from the point of view of political ideas. You know, everything from...
What have you done? Thousands of years of building and rebuilding, creating and recreating so you can let it crumble to dust. A million years, the sensitive men dying for their dreams, for what? So you can swim and dance and play.
All right, folks, and welcome back. This is a special recorded interview that we're having with Professor Matt Johnson, a PhD, and, of course, you know, as he just said, he's authored this book now on Putin. And did you want to mention a little bit about what will be in the book, or would you rather wait until it comes out, Matt?
No, I don't mind talking about it. This is my fifth book, but it is my first book that deals with contemporary things.
Yeah.
My previous four have all been historical, Slavic and medieval in their basic point of view. This is the first time I've done anything in the 20th century, in the 21st century. And the basic point of view is I'm trying to reconstruct from Putin's speeches as well as the political party that he heads in the country what his basic political philosophy is. And then, briefly, how that has actually worked itself out in institutions. Because the institutional stuff has been done a million times, I don't get into that very much. What I'm dealing with here is going through the Kremlin archives, most of which are online now, and figuring out what this man has said over the last 10, 15 years, his public speeches, his written work, how to put this all together into some kind of coherent political philosophy. And the commentators up until now have even gone so far as to say that he doesn't have a political philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a pragmatist of one kind or another. And I think over the late, you know, since at least 1999, I'm seeing a definite point of view emerging over the years, and that's yet to be put down in a coherent form. And that's what I'm trying to do here. So it's an original work, and overwhelmingly it's based on primary sources, his speeches, etc.
Okay. Now, when that time comes, we'd like to maybe delve into it more, and then we could take some questions and comments, you know, pro and con, to see what people think about it. But in the meantime, let me ask you now, as far as you survey the current world scene, particularly what's been happening in that region, in really the Slavic nations of the world, and in Europe itself today, what do you see emerging as the new political force? Do you see this new world order shaping and forming? Do you see powers being orchestrated by the Rothschild dynasties and the international banksters that are realigning themselves to offer a world global solution to the problems they've helped create?
Well, yeah, you know that we agree completely on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Nothing is ever as it seems.
Right.
I'm of the position that politicians don't have very much power.
Right.
Especially in the Western world. These are frontmen. Political institutions, you know, parliaments and presidents and everything else, these are people who are put in position by the people with money and real influence, real power, so that when something goes wrong, the economic powers that be don't take the blame. Politicians take the blame.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've never really heard a coherent understanding of how a president, say the president of the United States,
yes,
has any real authority, any real power over the economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even have power over the money.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is all in private hands, but
sure.
When something goes wrong, media usually refer to political elites and only political elites as being somehow responsible.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I remember that myself when I was in my college years going through the Nixon administration. You know, I remember how Nixon shifted his economic philosophy, as you recall, and he declared at one point, "I am now a Keynesian in economics," you know, as if he tried, you know, the real free market, free enterprise solution to the problems, when of course he didn't. And then it was the free enterprise system that took the blame, and of course he was telling us how good interventionism was and how good socialism was. And there was a Republican, you know, Richard Nixon, who gave us the big government philosophy that Lyndon Johnson couldn't complete with his war on poverty, the Great Society, and so forth. So it proves the paradigm, I think, that you're illustrating, that no matter which party is in power, whoever's in the White House, it matters not a whit regarding the outcome in the monetary policies, the fiscal policies, and so forth.
Well, the only people who have power are those who have money.
Mm-hmm.
And financial wealth, financial power, is concentrated really in a handful of people. And this is, now, I've never believed for a minute that Marxism, communism, Leninism had ever had anything to do with the workers and with labor. That was never the purpose of Marxism. The purpose of Marxism was to bring this small revolutionary elite to power and essentially to transfer the wealth from the country to this very small party elite.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the Soviet Union, this was, at least in Lenin's time, in the early period of Stalin's rule until the early 30s, was disproportionately Jewish.
Yep.
And they really sucked the wealth and the life out of Russia, and then later on in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the proletariat was a screen to hide behind. The proletariat was more exploited under Marxism than it ever was under capitalism.
Yeah.
But the broader point is that politicians that are elected in the Western world are elected only because they've been given a certain amount of money and prestige by those who have real power.
Right.
Now, the one event that I think made that clear to all but the dumbest of people is the bailout of the bankers.
Mm-hmm.
The bailout, which I guess is now over $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the Republicans saying that we don't have enough money for Social Security, we don't have enough money for Medicare, but we have enough money for the war, and we have enough money to bail out every major banker out there, no matter what their policy has been. And to add insult to injury, these people won't permit the American taxpayer to have any control or any say over how these companies run.
Yeah, yeah.
So the bailout proved, and there's no getting out of this, the bailout proved that liberal democracy is a complete fraud, that what we live under is a corporate and financial oligarchy.
Right.
They finance both parties.
Mm-hmm.
They finance all social and political movements,
mm-hmm.
neoliberalism, neoconservatism.
Mm-hmm.
And that explains, and is the main explanation, as to why Rick Adams and Matt Johnson are on these radio networks attacking and trying to delegitimize these people. But I do think that as the regime is no longer capable of delivering the goods, I think a real radical movement will slowly begin to form, even among middle-class people who are now losing their homes.
Yes. You know, that bailout, that massive transfer of wealth from the American taxpayer to them, the international global Zionist elite, was pretty well a done deal. And that was, you remember, the final years of Bush, the final months. And Bush, of course, held the Congress under lock and key, if I recall, basically told them they had to pass this or, you know, they wouldn't open the doors. I mean, this is, you know, Wall Street wasn't the issue, it was Main Street, it was middle America, and if we didn't pass it, the whole economic, structure would collapse. And sure enough, They were ready to collapse it if we didn't obey them, which, again, proves your point, Matt, is that we are not in control of our destiny. We are not in control of economics or politics or elections or anything of the sort. And you know, this is so much evident now that it's pretty hard to imagine how any but the dumbest of dumb, as you say, cannot see it.
You're absolutely correct, and it seems to me that as far as any kind of long-term thinking is concerned, what we're looking for is a political movement that is economically pretty radical in terms of taking the money from this tiny oligarchy who controls it,
mm-hmm.
and actually being able to give it to the people who produce it. But on the other hand, to be socially and ethnically conservative, where the ethnicity and the tradition of our various peoples can be normative for how we live our lives. And that's the one political movement that does not exist. I mean, you have the conservatives who are, you know, they may spout the line of being culturally conservative, but have no problem with oligarchy. You have the left that claims to have a problem with oligarchy, but is socially very liberal. Both of them play into the hands of the system.
Mm-hmm.
The only movement that would make any sense to me is one that's very worker-centered,
mm-hmm.
very farmer-centered, populist in that respect,
mm-hmm.
but still reflects them in terms of their basic, what we used to call family values, or the primacy of the family and the local community over the individual. And that's, I guess, what we would call nationalism, populism, social nationalism,
mm-hmm.
something like that. And those governments around the world that do have their, that basic point of view have always been under attack and have called themselves, or have been called by Amnesty International, George Soros, fascist governments or authoritarian governments. And that is really what's behind these, coordinated riots and protests in places like Syria.
Right, exactly. I see we're going to have to take another break, and I'm glad you mentioned that, the Middle East, and we're going to get back to European issues, the Middle East, and the whole world scene when we continue our interview with Professor Matt Johnson. I'm Rick Adams, right here on RVN. We will continue. Back, ladies and gentlemen, with our pre-recorded interview with Matt Johnson. And Matt, you just brought up Syria, and I had previously brought up Europe and what is going on in the Slavic nations. Can we just ask you, what is your view as to what is going on today in the new transformation following the changes that took place in the 1990s with regard to the Soviet apparatus and so forth? What do you think has happened now with the sucking sound that at least I've heard taking place within Europe, and particularly, you know, Eastern Europe? The sieve opened up for these world Zionist Jewish banksters and investors, you know, from Poland to Hungary and so forth. What has happened lately in those countries, as far as you're concerned, and NATO as well?
Well, from the Russian point of view, 10 years ago, it was normal for both neoconservatives and neoliberals, who generally agree on everything. They agree on their ends, but they may disagree over means. Their view was that Russia has to lean towards Europe. Europe meaning the major financial centers of, you know, Paris and London and the major bankers who control the politics there. But since the collapse of these economies and the massive unemployment in Western Europe, the rioting that began in Greece and then in Ireland and then Iceland even before that, the Russian elite are looking at Western Europe and saying, what exactly are we going to join over there? Why should we join it? And we have these long-standing ties with China and India, both of which are growing rapidly. And on top of that, we have long-standing ties with the anti-Israel, anti-Zionist Middle Eastern governments, the first of which was Iraq, the second of which was Syria, and only very recently, the third of which is now Iran. And so what we seem to have is the recreation of a bipolar world, the first one led largely by Washington, D.C., and the elite financial institutions that control it, and the second one being kind of a loose coalition of Russia, China, and smaller countries like Syria and Iran and Armenia on the other side. And that is, in my opinion, what's behind this constant obsession with regime change from Burma to China to Belarus to Syria to Egypt over the last 5-7 years.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. Now, in addition to that, what about the NATO alliance and how NATO has been orchestrated into this latest bombing campaign in Libya, for instance? This is something that, you know, that Italy came into a little bit later on. And, you know, you have to wonder about what the real purpose is here. And I'm sure you have views on Libya and what you think has been orchestrated there. Certainly it's not for the ostensible reasons that we were put there. This man in the White House put us there, a humanitarian reason. So what do you think is going on with regard to the NATO alliance being used and also America's role in all of this in Libya particularly?
Well, you know, I'm not going to claim to ever be an expert on North African politics, but I do know that Gaddafi, in many ways, was a very good man and a very good leader. One of his primary interests is very much what Saddam Hussein did in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
The concept is to use this oil money to plow back into the society in order to create first world countries, first world infrastructures, first world militaries, first world trading organizations, so as to be able to challenge American banking dominance and London banking dominance on their own turf. And at the same time, Islamic banking, which of course does not charge interest, which is something that has not been talked about all that much relative to this a spate of organized protests in all of these, you know, this part of the world. But NATO is merely a tool of those with financial power. It doesn't seem to have a purpose except that they serve largely as mercenaries for the New World Order and for the regime. And what at one point had been the very honorable role of soldier or sailor or policeman now really is nothing other than a hired gun, mercenary assassins for the London and Washington, D.C. elites, New York City elites.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the concept. You know, the U.S. and the Israelis were very upset starting in the mid-'80s with Saddam Hussein because what he cared about more than anything else was to use the oil money as well as support that he was getting from the Soviet Union and to a lesser extent China, and to put that into building a first world infrastructure.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the Chinese are in the process of doing that. South Korea has already done it. Taiwan has already done it. It's certainly nothing impossible. This kind of natural resource, the oil and natural gas and other things that Libya and Iraq have, it's not outrageous to say that if these leaders were to continue this long-term policy, they would be able to challenge Israel and the New World Order right on their own terms.
So they got to be destroyed.
And so they needed to be destroyed, and they needed to be reduced to fourth world status. And that's what's behind a lot of these things. And not only in terms of economics.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
And we're back now with Matt, and we're talking about a variety of issues here in all over the world, basically, with geopolitical strategies and all of the nuances of this new world order structure. How about South America right now, Matt, and what's going on below the equator particularly? You know, we hear a lot about billionaire, or should I say trillionaire, socialist, internationalist, globalist, you know, from one wing of the Jewish party, from the Soroses to the other, the Koches, and everybody in between, you know, the Bronfman family, the Adelsons, and so forth, about this shift of people who are looking toward moving south, south of the hemisphere, the southern hemisphere, because they're doing such a job of destroying the northern hemisphere. And everything, you know, around the globe, including America, with the ecological disasters of BP and many of these other multinationals, that these people are looking for a getaway. That's what I'm hearing, you know, from a lot of people. And, you know, one has something lined up in Dubai, Dick Cheney maybe. One of the others has something lined up in Peru or Paraguay or what have you. What are you hearing, and what do you think about what's going on with all of these disasters and earthquakes and what's happened to Japan, for instance? And what do you make of this rumination, so to speak?
Well, I think that a lot of governments throughout the world are really detecting the weakness of the Western economic elites. The banks are being bailed out with money that has to be borrowed from other banks. And the result of this is that because the resources of the Western world are absolutely stretched to the limit, the system has needed to use other methods to get their way. And this kind of fake revolution, largely funded by those same people that you mentioned, has been the method of doing this. Now, as far as Latin America is concerned, again, I don't speak Spanish. I'm not a Latin American scholar by any means, but I have followed a lot of the work being done in Venezuela. And I think that Chavez has really threatened the regime by the creation of his Bank of the South. His Bank of the South is to Latin America and to the Third World in general what the Islamic banking movement is in the Islamic world. It's a way to opt out of the elite system, to have a banking sector that is dedicated solely to the nationalist and localist movement throughout the world, really a culturally conservative movement, for lack of a better phrase, and being based on very different principles. So the Bank of the South is something located and headquartered in Caracas. It is financed by the elite in this part of the world that wants nothing to do with what are clearly failing Western institutions. And so you have Islamic banking growing that does not charge interest. Instead, what they do is they, when they loan money to somebody, they become partners with that person in their enterprise. Mm-hmm. And they get paid back in the profits of that enterprise. So no interest is charged, no usury is being charged. Mm-hmm. And so the point is that Islamic banking now is worth several billion dollars. It continues to grow and continues to be a source of finance throughout that part of the world that has no connection whatsoever to the New World Order. And Chavez, although not a Muslim, is doing the same kind of thing in Latin America with his Bank of the South. So the point is, as the Western world clearly shows its bankruptcy literally in terms of its financial situation and ideologically in terms of its basic political point of view, these fairly charismatic leaders throughout the world are beginning to build their own institutions. Now, Chavez in Venezuela is fairly popular. It's very difficult to penetrate his movement. He's aware of the attempts of CIA and Mossad to penetrate Venezuela and to create this artificial revolution. They tried to do the same thing in Belarus with a very similar kind of leadership, and they failed. They tried it in Russia, and they haven't tried it in Russia in a decade. There's simply no way to penetrate Putin's popularity. The military clamped down on this kind of nonsense in Burma. The Chinese economic growth is so extraordinary, they had to go to the Dalai Lama and put him on the CIA payroll to get... To alter the fact that Gaddafi's forces are more or less loyal, and what the regime is doing is taking advantage of the social cleavages that exist really in any society. There's certainly more disaffection and anger in America than anywhere else, and yet because there is no charismatic leadership in America to organize any kind of, especially in rural areas, to organize and dispossess, nothing is really happening. Although it should be noted that a significant thing is the firing of Glenn Beck from Fox News, and it was really, he would not have a big fan of his, but he was fired for one reason and one reason only.
Yes.
And that was that he came out and said George Soros is financing these movements in Syria and Egypt and everywhere else. These are artificial, fake rebellions, and these political movements are being financed by the elite. And that was it. Once you say that, once you show the world that their political system is controlled by a handful of oligarchs, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what caused Glenn Beck's firing. And of course, he's absolutely correct. These are all fake rebellions, no more than the two-party system in America is equally fake.
Right. And everybody knew it, but nobody dared to talk about it on any of the other programs.
And that's why Glenn Beck was fired.
And that's why that's why what you're saying is true, by the way.
Yeah, and so now that sent a message to anybody else who thinks of saying something very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, within, what, a few weeks or a month after that, Osama bin Laden allegedly showed up dead.
Again.
Which is a lot of nonsense.
Right.
A lot of fake. I mean, the photoshopping that they're trying to promote is awful. It's not even good photoshopping. I mean, it's something that I could do on my computer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they've become so cynical and angry right now that they're willing to pretty much say anything to make their agenda work out. So.
Well, that's true. And now you touch on something that's near and dear to our heart, the whole hoax of 9/11. And if people, the American public, were gullible enough, at least about 49% of them, to believe everything the government claims about 9/11, then they'll believe in the tooth fairy, and they'll believe that Osama bin Laden was just killed, and that this Al-Qaeda, so-called, and the Taliban will be competing forces against America and the free world for the next 99 years. And they'll believe that they can send their children off to fight these wars, and on and on and on it goes. So, as one man says, one of our dear brothers says, Rick, if that house of cards collapses, the whole 9/11 lie, or World War II lie, or anything else, then the whole deck collapses. Everything collapses. And they can't afford to have that. They just simply cannot permit that, Matt.
Well, and that explains almost 100% why we are in the situation that we're in. It shows us that our work, especially in terms of history, is the single most important discipline we can engage in for the sake of delegitimizing this system. And my experience, and I think the experience of a lot of your listeners, is that when you bring this stuff up in social setting, you better be willing to fight.
Mm-hmm.
You better be willing to physically defend yourself.
Yeah.
Because these people need to believe this.
Oh, absolutely. They get paid to believe it, too. I mean, there are grants and scholarships and all sorts of things that come with it, the baggage. And you yourself know from your academic experience what has happened when you have been a thorn in their side, haven't you?
Well, that was what I dedicated my life to, and I paid for it. And I was told this in no uncertain terms. I was told that you can't teach here because you have a political and religious point of view that simply can't be tolerated.
Mm-hmm.
And even if, you know, you have a lot of these honest liberals that want to hear every point of view, but they realize that even if they permit me to function, they will then be in trouble. So they pretty much will say and do anything to get rid of me, and I realized that I was putting my friends in a very bad position because they ended up having a lot of pressure put on them from the outside, even to the point where a university, if enough people like me are teaching there, will get its accreditation pulled.
Oh, sure.
Because, well, accreditation is based almost exclusively on ideological concerns.
Right.
And if, like, for example, Hillsdale College, I think is in Illinois.
Yep.
Got its accreditation.
No, actually, I think it was in Michigan.
Right.
Michigan.
Well, wherever they are, the point is, they got their accreditation removed because mm-hmm. they refused to engage in any kind of affirmative action program.
Right, right.
So that meant that the government would no longer finance any loans given to students who are going to Hillsdale.
Yeah, yeah.
That means the college needed to finance its own a loan program.
And they did, too, I think, too. And they became defined as a recipient institution, meaning that if you accepted students with government loans and grants, then you are now the property of the government. Somehow, you know, you are their property. And they didn't agree with that.
And that way they can control.
Right.
So you have government control and then you have private sector control.
Exactly.
Through the grant mechanism. And not to mention the method of tenure where you only get voted on by other tenured professors.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a way to control who stays and who goes.
Right.
And of course I realized fairly early on that this was not going to be for me because there's no way that these people could ever vote for me regardless of my accomplishments in the field. So that's what we're fighting against, and that's why it's so significant that the Internet continue to act as this way for a lot of our point of view to get out and to get a lot of following people who have never heard this kind of stuff before.
Right. I'd like to just ask you now, before we are going to take a break, about the movement within the church now, within the, I believe it's the Russian Orthodox Church now that you are a pastor in. Is that right, or am I wrong on that?
Who I'm under right now is the Autonomous Church in Western Europe and America, both North and South America.
And it's an Orthodox Christian.
It is an Orthodox, church which derives from, two patriarchs of Kiev and Ukraine, Mstislav and Vladimir.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in communion with, among other people, the Ukrainians in Bukovina, who were a catacomb group under the communist system, who, of course, lived and worked underground so as not to have any contact with the communist system. And these are the people who we derived from and we are allied with.
Right.
The Orthodox Church, even amongst its more mainline institutions in Russia and in Ukraine and elsewhere, has made it fairly clear that they are opposed to the development of what we call the New World Order, and they write about it and talk about it pretty openly. Especially if you could read the Russian language, you could read about this stuff on a regular basis. And so while the bulk of Catholics and Protestants are not only not opposed to the New World Order, but are in fact a significant part of the New World Order, the Orthodox Churches, by and large, have begun to define themselves as outside of it and opposing it. And so, as far as Russia is concerned, you have a fairly close alliance of Vladimir Putin's movement on the one hand, with many significant elements in the church on the other, making it clear that they are fighting the New World Order and that they'll do whatever it can to do damage to it. My only problem right now with the church in Russia is that they're still a member of the World Council of Churches, which I just don't understand what they're getting out of this, because the Orthodox Church of Bulgaria, Serbia, and Georgia all have withdrawn from the World Council of Churches. Why Russia is lagging in this regard, I simply don't know. But needless to say, the institutions that I'm a part of have absolutely nothing to do with the WCC, which is a Rockefeller organization, and it's, in my opinion, one of the talents of Antichrist.
Right. Yeah, and on the other side, well, I shouldn't say opposite side, but sort of right of center, are the new evangelicals, which were set up, you know, years ago, to the Billy Grahamites, to sort of stem the tide of people leaving the Council of Churches and going to the ICCC, like the International Council of Christian Churches, and people like that on the far right. You know, they are the ones who are even more dangerous than the World Council, because they're preaching this new evangelicalism that embraces this dispensationalist theology and Israel theology, so to speak. So between them and the ones on the fundamental right, they walk in lockstep with these so-called chosen people in Palestine, you see?
I couldn't agree more with you. And these people, you know, I've debated these people. I've been fighting with these people for years and years and years, whether in Catholic or Protestant backgrounds. And essentially how you can describe them is, number one, they worship the Jews as divinity. And, of course, both the Talmud and the Kabbalah, the Zohar, do claim in no uncertain terms that Jews are, collectively speaking, a divinity.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that in some sense, a lot of these people do take that seriously, even if they can't articulate it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've noticed that a lot of these people are very robotic in the sense that they have memorized slogans that they have gotten from their social superiors,
mm-hmm,
and repeat them uncritically.
Yeah.
And no matter what you say, and no matter what kind of evidence you bring up,
oh sure,
they either will start screaming and cursing, or they will get physical.
Yeah.
And, I'm a relatively muscular person, and thank God for that, because there's been times where I've had to use that.
Yeah.
And that's something that we can't ignore. It's something that's very real, and from a purely spiritual point of view, I know that the demons and malicious spirits are a part of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's always been my opinion that these people aren't possessed, because really, what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point of possessing them when they're already doing the will of the regime?
Right.
So
they become very, as you said, very un-Christian, very intolerant when you try to expose their fanaticism and their false doctrines.
Whatever needs to be done, we gotta do ourselves.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, with our recorded interview with Professor M. Raphael Johnson. And he is with me in this hour here tonight because he has so graciously consented to be on this recorded interview. It's a little bit late when I'm on at night, so it's kind of tough for him to keep up and, have the mental acuity he normally has at that hour when I'm on. It's hard enough for me. So here we are airing this broadcast that we did just a few days ago. And, Matt, you mentioned these clerics and these religious people, really politicians, you know, in religious garb. It reminds me of the wolves in sheep's clothing today. And, you know, every one of them always has as their centerpiece the dollar or the shekel. I mean, at the end of the service, in the middle, the beginning, it's always about money, it seems. And that usually is a telltale sign for me, as far as I'm concerned with it. There are ministries in support of Zionism and Israelism and all of these wars. I mean, they're hoping for an Armageddon. They're actually moving toward the building of that temple, you know, in Jerusalem and inflaming the whole world. So it's interesting to see how they're serving Satan so well. That's my comment.
Well, yeah, the last time I was in Nebraska, you know, I was at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln for a long time.
Yeah.
And the last time I was there, I did a lot of driving in the rural areas in southern Nebraska and northern Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very depressed. You know, rural areas are absolutely poverty-stricken. No one cares about them. They've been dehumanized as hicks and yokels, and so you can very easily destroy their way of life. But I noticed that when I drove through those parts of America, there's a lot of rundown homes, a lot of abandoned farms, but there were very large, brand-new Protestant churches wherever I went, sometimes huge institutions in the middle of areas that had very few actual people.
Mm-hmm.
So these people have money, and, you know, I don't know how I feel about tax exemptions for a lot of, you know, because...
Well, you know how I feel is that they shouldn't be tax exempt to begin with, these 501c3s, because the government basically is in the driver's seat.
Well, that's true. I mean, the tax exemption means that the state controls it.
Right, exactly.
Live, uncensored, Radio Free America. Another exciting, informative hour is warming up. Rick Adams is on fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though synagogue, by definition, is not a religious institution,
mm-hmm.
a synagogue primarily is a place for political mobilization.
Right.
The only place that you can really worship is at the Temple in Jerusalem, which hasn't existed in an awful long time.
Mm.
And so the synagogue, you know, there's plenty of atheist Jews who go to the synagogue because they know this is a place for political mobilization,
yeah,
and
exactly.
political propaganda, and that'll be the day that the IRS ever thinks about pulling their taxes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think you've got something there. You know, the clock's ticked away so fast that we're almost out of time. In the last minute, can I just have you give your final word about your radio program and how people can reach you or listen in? Go right ahead, Matt.
It's very easy. I'm at the Voice of Reason, Broadcast Network. That's very easy to find online. You can simply search for it. We have a bunch of shows. We have a wildly diverse group of people. Some people deal with just German stuff. I deal mostly with Russian and religious stuff. We have people dealing with racial and other kinds of religious and identity kind of material.
Mm-hmm.
We got people from all over the place.
Right.
We have a huge amount of hits and a huge amount of listeners. And this is why I shifted a lot of my web space over to them.
Right.
Because we can get a lot more exposure that
sure,
way.
Sure, sure.
And like I said to you at the beginning of the program, you know, we are definitely allies. We have the same movement. We're not in competition with each other.
No.
And this is something very, very important to me personally.
Yes, it is. And I am very grateful that you took time out of your schedule to join me on this program. And we definitely will do it again when your book comes out. And we'll also get into other areas as well. And Matt, thank you for being with Rick Adams tonight on this program.
Yeah, it's an honor for me, Rick. Thank you.
You're
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
tuned in to Radio Aryan.